You're listening to Coach Your Brains Out by Gold Medal Squared. This is part two of our conversation with Bernie Holiday about the training and trusting mindsets. Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen. Does the trusting mindset require complete freedom, or can you still have constraints within the game? I'm thinking about, like, we do drills where we're playing and we're scoring, let's say, a normal game 21, but within that, on our own side, we have some constraints like, hey, we call it a USA drill where we need to get, like, a U would be maybe two aces or some objective, like two kills on two or something like that. So you're not completely free. There are some like things you're focusing on working outside of maybe your comfort zone. Can you still be in the trusting mindset with those constraints, or does it need to be completely open like a real game?
Well, I think with the trusting mindset, it's about the intention and conviction. So when you put constraints on a drill, you're providing intention. And I think the degree to which they're willing to commit to that, let's say it might be a right side versus a right side drill where you got to attack. Right sides can only attack against right center points. And otherwise, they can keep the rally going, but you only get points when you attack the right side. That becomes the intent. And when you ask a player, hey, what were you thinking? And the player is telling you, I was thinking about my approach. And I was thinking about my passing. And you realize that their intention was all over the place. That'd be more an example of where they're stuck in training mindset mode. And they're not committed to the intent that you brought to the drill. So I think those drills are great. The constraints are great. And the constraints actually bring an intentionality that can allow you to leverage and practice that conviction and reckless abandon piece. You know, hey, we've got this constraint. We have to play it this way. How convicted were you? How much reckless abandon did you bring to being able to play it this way?
So I think we have, and you shared the secret weapon of the training and trusting mindset, which I really think is this think box, play box, which you shared with us when you were with us at LMU. So can you take us through what that is?
Well, as you guys have probably realized sitting here for the last 30 minutes with me or 45 minutes, the training mindset, trusting mindset concept can be kind of heady. It can be kind of abstract. And while I believe wholeheartedly in it, I had trouble describing how to apply it on court or on the field. And I was at a conference probably 5 years ago, and Annika Sorenstam's coaches were the keynotes. And Annika Sorenstam is she's probably one of the, you know, use the analogy or the metaphor, GOAT, the greatest of all time. So she may be the greatest of all time female golfer in history, or one of them at least. You know, she's one of the best to have ever played golf. And her coaches were keynotes. And as they were being interviewed, they were asked what allowed Annika to have so much success in her career. And they said, well, simply, it was her ability to master the think box, play box. And I scratched my head and I wrote it down. And as they described it, I took notes and I thought, this sounds pretty cool. I wish I knew it better. And then, 3 years later, Annika herself became the keynote at that very same conference, and she was being interviewed. And when she was asked, hey, how did you have such overwhelming success in your career? She goes, well, I attribute a large part of it to my ability to master the think box, play box. And I'm like, here it is again. This is the think box, play box. What's going on? And as she described it, she said, as I approach the ball, I go into what I call the think box. And that's where I analyze the lie. I look at the pin placement. I check the wind. I think about club selection. I think about shot arc and the way I want to work a shot. And I also work through some of my doubts, some of my insecurities, some of my hesitations and second guesses. And I do all this in the think box. And then there's the thing I call the decision line. And at that point, I've got a trigger. My trigger is my glove, my golf glove. I put my golf glove on. I pull my club out. Now I'm in the play box. Now I approach the ball. I look at my target. I set up and I swing. If at any time I start to second guess or question my club selection, or at any time I start to second guess or question the wind that just kicked up or the lie of the ball at my feet, I step back, I put the club back in the bag, I take the glove off, and I go back into the think box and I reassess. And I wait until I'm able to commit to something. And when I can commit to something, I can commit to that decision. I can cross the decision line, put the glove back on, and I play the shot. And she said, I've gotten really good over the years at being able to think in the box and then cross that decision line and be able to play in the play box. And as she described other golfers that she's watched, she said, a lot of times you see them thinking in the play box. And that's a real big challenge. And other times you see them playing in the think box where they haven't prepared adequately. So they have nothing to trust, nothing to commit to when they step into the play box. So for her, that was the dance that she did between every shot, was being in the think box, analyzing it, working through it, working through the fears, the worries, the anxieties, the strategies, and then being able to commit to something, cross that line into the play box, get into trusting mindset mode, and hit the ball. And that's where I started thinking, this is a very simple metaphor for training mindset mode in the think box and then trusting mindset mode in the play box. So I shared it with baseball. I'm like, hey, baseball, we've got a rubber, we've got a batter's box. This makes sense. And our baseball players and our coaches were like, yeah, we think too much in the play box. And then I shared it with my volleyball circle and said, coaches and players, what do you guys think about this? And they go, you know what? This makes perfect sense. We think too much in the play box. So it was funny that there was this tendency in both sports to be able to say, hey, we recognize this. This makes sense. Our think box tendencies bleed into and contaminate our play box purity, where we want to be in pure trusting mindset mode. And we want to get better at separating the two. So that's kind of where the whole idea originated. And we've been playing with it this year a lot in volleyball. And it's created for a ton of really cool dialogue.
Yeah. How are some ways that you guys have seen, have worked with volleyball players to use the think box play box? Obviously, it's a little different because there's some time constraints and there's no batter's box. How have you guys incorporated it?
Yeah, we wrestled a lot with how much control we have in dictating the pace of play. And I didn't think we had a lot of control in volleyball, but my volleyball coaches told me there's more control than you think. We can find ways to stall. We can find ways to drag our feet. We can put the ball down and tie our shoe, ask for time to tie our shoe. We can wipe up some sweat on the court. There are some ways that we can control the pace of play, so we can have some control over it. But still, we are kind of constrained by that 15 seconds between points. In baseball, there's a very deliberate play box. There's a rubber for a pitcher who stands there. There's an actual box that a hitter stands in for a play box for hitting. But volleyball, you got it on the serve because you stand at the back line. And as soon as you get that ball, there's a play box moment. But if you're in serve receive, it's a little bit more gray. It's kind of like defense in baseball where you've got an area. But so I think a lot of it's finding out how it looks in defense, how it looks in serve receive. And finding out what are the triggers in volleyball. You know, Annika talked about her glove being that trigger when she moves from training mindset to trusting mindset. In baseball, Mike Schmidt, who's a Hall of Fame player, third baseman for the Phillies, his transition from think box to play box, he called it his last conscious thought. And in his think box, when he was outside of the box, the hitter's box, he would think, I'm going to hit a line drive to the pitcher's shins. And that was what he called his last conscious thought. And that's when he moved into the play box. He stepped into the actual batter's box, put the bat up on his shoulder, and got ready to hit. And as we were talking through with some volleyball coaches and we were war gaming this idea, we came up with in serving, really, it's sort of that very, very first element of the pre-serve routine. When you start that very first element of your pre-serve routine as a server, you are now in the play box. So you need to find a way in that 15 seconds to get through the think box of where I want to serve, how I want to execute the serve, and what are some of my worries about missing the serve, and get to a place where you can commit to your intention, get that ball, begin that pre-serve routine, and go. We found a little bit harder in serve receive, but some of our coaches talked about just some physical gestures that they do on the court, such as cleaning the soles of their sneakers on their socks or using the palms of their hands to clean their sneakers, meaning clean slate, next point, let's go. And that becomes that trigger for them on moving from think box, where I'm thinking about passing and serve receive, to now I'm ready to serve receive, I'm ready to pass. And something that John and Betsy actually did in their beach practice, which I thought was fascinating, Betsy picked this up really quick. She heard us talk about training trusting mindset and think box play box the day before. And what was interesting was the next day during their beach practice, she saw them thinking and analyzing and criticizing and being frustrated and judgmental about about their passing, standing there as about to pass. And she actually drew an actual box in the sand and said, this is where you serve receive. This is actually your think box. If you're going to do that stuff, step out, do it out there. Don't pollute this environment. When you're ready, when you can commit to something, then step in and go. And it was neat to be able to see her actually draw a physical box in the sand that they could then use to metaphorically represent, I need to do my frustration and my emoting and my thinking outside of that box, but I can't carry that in. And when they were ready, they take one or two steps forward into that actual box drawn in the sand. And now they're in the play box mode.
And can you share the name that you have for the play box?
Oh, geez. I don't know if I even remember that. That was kind of on the spot.
Really? Oh, that was so good. I remember it. The sacred swagger space.
That's right. Yeah. Your sacred swagger space where you don't pollute it with the crap you carry into it. It's got to be sacred. And that's where you find your swagger.
Yeah.
Don't bring the doubt and the worry and the anxiety into that place.
I love that name. And what happens when you bring, you know, that training mindset into that swagger space?
You typically hear players talk about the game speeding up on them, that they feel like it's a step behind the game. That's often when you'll see the paralysis by analysis kick in, where their movements become overly mechanical, their movements become a little bit more slower, and they look less athletic. And I think what you really see, and I think what coaches will notice, is the execution. You lose that conviction, you lose that reckless abandon, and their execution becomes very careful. Their execution becomes very cautious. They become very timid. And you'll see that oftentimes when it gets blocked a couple times, and then they start just trying to tip and roll around the block, but not really doing much with the ball, just kind of basically giving to the opposition for a free ball. You'll often see it in serving, where if they're afraid of missing a serve or if they're behind and it's close to the end of the game, they'll just hit the serve in for the sake of hitting the serve in rather than trying to get a flat, hard serve that forces not a system pass. So the execution becomes very cautious, timid, and careful. That's typically what you'll see. And what's interesting, too, is something that I think you and Betsy picked up on, which I thought was really exciting, too, was how coaches can often coach players when the player's in the play box. And in baseball, you see this happen a lot, where a player is standing on the rubber about to pitch in his practice session. And as he's getting ready to pitch, the coach is yelling out 10 or 15 different mental cues to remember as he's pitching. Or the player's in the batter's box with the bat on their shoulder about to hit off a tee, and the coach is giving him 5 reminders of what he needs to think about and do about his mechanics to be able to hit off the tee. And the brain is really, really good at making pairs and making associations between things. You may have both heard of the Pavlov's dog association back in, I don't know, the early 1900s, I guess. I should know that better, being a sports psychology major. But basically, a study where they would ring a bell, they would show a dog food, the dog would hear the bell, see the food, he would salivate, and he would eat. And over time, they would ring this bell, show the food, the dog would hear the bell, see the food, salivate, and eat. But eventually, they just rung the bell. They wouldn't even prevent the food, but just by hearing the bell, the dog would salivate. Because as human beings and as dogs, our brains are really good at creating associations and pairing things together. So that dog paired that bell with the meaning of food, and even without seeing food, he would salivate. And the same thing happens with our coaching and our athletes when they're in the play box. If they're in the play box, let's say in my case, a pitcher's on the rubber or a hitter's in the box practicing, or coaching them while they're in there, their brain starts to make the association, hey, when I'm in this play box place, I need to be thinking about all these things. I need to remember all these mental cues about my mechanics. And the brain pairs that place, that type of thinking. So it was really cool to actually see Betsy out on the sand when she said, hey, I got something for you. Step out of the play box for a minute. Come here. Coached them up out of the play box, gave them 30 seconds of coaching, some feedback, got some questions asked, and then said, okay, get back to the play box and go. Show me you can do it. And she was able to separate, you know, getting them out of the play box in practice to coach them up, and then put them back in the play box so that she didn't dilute it as a coach. Now that's pie in the sky ideal. I know it's not going to work that way all the time, but I think the more we can coach them out of the play box, even if it's just one or two steps out, and then put them back in the play box so that the brain doesn't associate play box with overthinking and overcorrection.
Just leave it to Betsy to come up with gold.
She's the best. She's the best.
No, that's, I think it's a really cool warning to know that other than your own thoughts, you know, the coach or your teammates can kind of pollute your play box as well. I know in volleyball, sometimes like we're giving our partner blocking signals as they're getting ready to serve. And if you're kind of like showing it or looking at that when you're in the play box, that definitely can distract. Bernie, if it makes sense to me, the intentionality and having a clear intention in the training mindset, what about, that makes sense for like a serve or like a baseball pitch. What about if it's more like a hit, or it's more of a reaction? So it's less of like, hey, I'm coming in with the intention of, you know, hitting this spot, but I need to maybe more improv, and I'm reacting to where the block is and the D. I could be shooting, I could be hitting, I could be hitting line. There's like a lot of variables. I guess, how would you carry that intentionality over there?
I think it's more of it's a great question, and it's a very challenging one, because yeah, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know where that ball's going to be set, if it's going to be tight up the net, off the net, if you're going to have to make an adjustment around the block, or the block's going to pull. So there's a lot of variables that might happen within 5 seconds that cause you to do something different. You can't have an intention not knowing what's going to happen before it happens. So I think it's more of an intention on not what you want to do, but the way you want to be. Hey, I'm going to be aggressive and attacking here. Hey, I'm going to be patient and I'm going to be patient with myself and supportive here. So it's more of a quality characteristic that you want to carry to the point rather than some kind of an action you want to take in the point. And those things might be different feelings like aggressiveness, being attacking, being patient, being supportive of your teammate. Hey, I want to be supportive. That's my intention for this point, is to really support and bring out my best in him. So it becomes a different type of focus, but it is very, it's different. It's hard. You're right. It doesn't really, it's not clean as I'm going to serve to zone six, or I'm going to serve to zone two and try to jam up the setter coming in and create traffic. It's a different look when you're going to have to freestyle out there a bit.
So to take us take us home with this think box, play box, say Billy, you know, for one time actually shanked a couple balls, maybe two or three. And he, what would he do? Kind of, can you take us through like what he would do when he stepped in to the play box? I'm sure it'd be easy to focus on three different things. But what would be like, I guess, what would be his process as he stepped in?
Yeah, not using Billy in particular, but just in general, if that kind of a situation happened, to me, a couple things would really benefit that player in that situation. One is being able to have some kind of a trigger that they use when they need to reset. And it might even be metaphorical, such as just filling in some of the holes in the sand, some of the divots that were created. And that metaphorically symbolizes, hey, clean slate. Everything's clean moving forward. The second thing is trying to get from the, I often talk about the A through Z's of serve receive, or any skill for that matter. There's probably 26 things you could teach me about serve receive, and I can try to do them all. It's better to know what the ABCs of serve receive are. So kind of narrowing it from 26 things that are important for serve receive to narrowing it down to what are my three? What are the three for me? What are my ABCs to serve receive? But then ultimately in that 15 seconds, what's my A? What's the one thing I know that gets my serve receive back on track? What's the one thing that I know helps me pass the ball really well? And that be the one thing that I commit to as I step in, cross that decision line and back in the play boxes. I've got a clean slate. I've had my trigger. I've recognized, hey, I've got my A. I've got my one thing that usually gets me aligned to serve receive really well. And being able to commit to that, that becomes my intention. And that's what I attack with conviction and reckless abandon for the next point. Is that kind Billy, of
a, yeah, no, that, that nailed it. I'm curious, Billy, what's your A?
I guess just my starting position in serve receive.
Bernie, could you upgrade that?
I'm not going to touch that. I think it's great.
Oh, I think you could upgrade it. What about being more, and he knows best what works for him. But I remember you also mentioned like how you can step into the play box with an emotion or a feeling that can be a part of it as well. And like, I didn't hear that as much there where it's like, that kind of like you step in and like serve me this ball, or maybe that's a body language part of it. I don't know. Can you just touch on that side of it?
I think the intention doesn't have to be a mechanical thing, but a lot of times it could be an attitude. I know when I'm talking with some of our indoor players, after they shank a couple passes, they get into that default mode of don't serve me. I don't want the ball. And their one thing might not be a mechanical thing, such as sort of how they get set up in their starting position, but it might be more a matter of my intention for this point is to want the ball and to be aggressive to the ball. Like, I want this serve, bring it to me. And that becomes their one intention for that next serve coming at them, because they're probably going to get picked on anyway. And that kind of mentality helps them shift back into more of a trusting mindset mode. So it doesn't always have to be a mechanical A when it comes to your ABCs, but it could be even an attitude thing or an emotion that you want to carry that, you know, helps you get back on track.
Yeah, that's a good clarification. So it could just depend on obviously the situation where you're at emotionally, and maybe at times a technical focus is appropriate, and others, yeah, an attitude, like you said. So I think that's a good distinction to consider. So we have, I have one more. It's kind of off topic, but I just loved this idea that you brought to us and wanted to make sure I had a chance to share it. It's on the school mindset. So can you just share what that is and how this mindset affects athletes?
Sure thing. Yeah, I just learned this last year, and I never heard it put this way before, but it immediately struck a chord with me, and it's something I'm probably going to use from here on out. And it really highlights confidence. And I think we as coaches and athletes tend to look at confidence in kind of tricky, weird ways. But as I was introduced to this idea of how school mindset is something that we grew up with for 18 years of our life, even 22 years of our life, depending on if we go to college or not. But it doesn't work in sport. Sport mindset's way different. And where we draw our confidence from in sport is way different. So here's the school mindset metaphor. Let's say you've got a big exam. It's a final exam. Your grade depends on it. So you, and I'm gonna spout sort of a scenario here. You work tirelessly, hours each day for weeks or months getting ready for this exam. Let's say you study every aspect of it. You studied inside and out. let's say you spend extra time on the harder parts of the topic of the course. You do dress rehearsals. In this case, it might be doing practice exams that are online that you could take, and you kind of put yourself into a practice exam mode. The night before, you get a good night's sleep, you get rested, you get fueled, have a good breakfast going into it. Let's say the teacher's fair and is a fair grader. What are your results likely to be if you've prepared at that quality level in that way? I think most of us probably say, you know, I think we do pretty well. I have a lot of confidence that I could be successful in this exam. I worked hard at it. I studied the harder stuff. I practiced exams. I got rest. I think I'm ready to go. And my guess is you're right, because we start to recognize that when we put that kind of effort in to our preparation, we're normally rewarded with a pretty good grade. Now, I'm going to change that scenario to, let's say you are competing in 2 weeks against your conference rival. You guys are both tied for first in your conference, and it's a highly competitive conference. You're both, like, let's say 8-1 in the conference. And you get ready for that match by, you work tirelessly for hours each week for the next couple weeks. Let's say you practice every aspect of your position. You practice it inside and out. Let's say you spend extra time on the harder parts of your position. Let's say you go through dress rehearsals, so you have game-like reps and scrimmages, and you have a scout squad that plays like the opposition. Let's say you are well-rested going into the match, and you're fueled that morning with a good breakfast, and now you play this opponent who's equally matched as you. What are your results likely to be? I think it's a lot harder for us to say, I'm sure I'm going to be successful, because we realize that I'm playing in opposition and the enemy gets a vote and they are preparing just like we are. So I'm going into it with a lot more uncertainty about the outcome. And I think what the school mindset falsely teaches us is that our confidence should be based on our certainty of success. I need to be confident that I'm going to succeed in the situation. Whereas I think true confidence is based on this belief that we can handle the uncertainty and adapt to the unknowns, and to not base our confidence on the belief that we'll succeed consistently, because in high level sport and at the highest levels in particular, the enemy gets a vote and there's no guarantee of success. So if we can have belief and certainty in our ability to handle and adapt to the unknowns of the sport, I think that's really true confidence. So it dawned on me why so many people struggle with confidence, because they base it on the school mindset, and that mindset just doesn't play in sport, especially high level sport.
Yeah, and after being trained one way for so long, it's hard for people to make that shift. I mean, obviously it's going to take time, but bringing the awareness is a great step. And I don't know if I'll ever completely make that shift, but hearing about this really opened my eyes up. So I think it's a really helpful lesson from you. So thanks.
Yeah, I think it's just the embracing uncertainty and embracing unknown, and not feeling like I have to feel like I've got the answers, know the answers, but to lean into the uncertainty is a big part of making that mental switch or shift.
Cool. And Bernie, we're going to end with some listener questions we got for you. So Joshua James asks, if a coach could do one thing to start coaching the mental game better, what would that one thing to start with be?
Ooh. Coaching the mental game better. You know, this is going to be sidestepping around the question a little bit, but I think it's going to directly address it. As I've watched coaches really leverage sound motor learning principles and skill acquisition principles in their practice design, I've realized that mental toughness is developed as a byproduct of really good practices. So as a practice has more game speed elements, when a practice has more game stress elements, when there's more unpredictability in a practice, when the practice requires more decision-making and puzzle solving and on-the-fly adaptation, mental toughness occurs and strengthens as a byproduct of a practice that's like that. So when you look at practices that are highly variable, that have random practice principles built in, that have contextual interference, that have more of that game speed, game stress, what you find is athletes have to focus more. They have to be able to refocus more because they get distracted more often. It's more stressful, so they have to learn composure and poise. And they get better at, again, what we talked about, true confidence, which is the confidence in my ability to adapt to the unknowns, because these practices are more unknown, they're more unpredictable. And athletes start having more confidence in their ability to manage themselves in those unpredictable environments, rather than being in an easy practice that doesn't stress them, that doesn't challenge their focus, that doesn't challenge their confidence. So I would say number one is just get really good at understanding the motor learning skill acquisition piece, and how do we apply that as a coach? Because that's going to create more mentally tough athletes as a byproduct. The other thing that comes to mind to me is it comes back to the error correction piece. I think our coaches in all sports are really good at giving specific informational statements on how to correct errors. But a lot of us fall into the trap of the empty praise when responding to successful reps. When an athlete has success, giving the attaboy or attagirl or there you go or nice hit, and not really providing something informational that gets reinforced or processed there by the athlete. So for me, it's, I think to develop the mental game better, it's when we give feedback on when things go right. And as coaches, when we hunt the good stuff, to get really good at giving specific informational feedback on what specific good stuff did happen that allowed the result that we were happy with.
Love hunt the good stuff. That's one we've definitely stolen from you. And I think it's a great thing to keep in mind as a coach and a player. We have another one from patron Will Buchanan from Mad Sand. He wants some specific examples of indoor or beach volleyball practices that focus on performing under pressure.
Maybe you guys can help me out with this one. What have you guys seen really helps create more of a pressure scenario to make it more game-like? Because you could probably say it's never going to feel like an AVP final. But what gets you closer to it?
I'd like to hear from Billy.
Yeah, I think this is always a tough one to try to recreate. Some things that I've seen done that maybe felt more pressure was when kind of the score is kind of kept for more than just that one game and washed. Like, I feel like a lot of games we play, the score is washed away. Like, I won't remember who won. But if it's like, you know, coaches writing it down or logging it, maybe that adds a little pressure. And then on the pro tour, we also, maybe you can't do this in high school or college. Sometimes you bet or gamble on the game, like for breakfast or lunch. And just having some sort of stakes like that maybe ups the pressure a little bit.
Yeah, another one I thought of that works a lot for us is when we put something on the line, like the loser has to carry the med tent or the med kit to the game tomorrow. But I also think, like, you taught us, Bernie, and talked to us about how pressure is a privilege and more just reframing the way you look at pressure, because I think people do experience pressure in practice and they feel it. And I think being able to identify it as a potentially helpful thing, I think that can help too. You could probably speak better on that.
Well, what's weird about pressure, and when we think about ourselves as kids, and I may have shared this with you guys during our last podcast together. I can't recall if I covered this one specifically, but this fascinates me that as kids, when we're 9 or 10 or 11, and we're playing out in the playground or we're playing in the field across the street from our house, we actually create pressure scenarios in our mind because they're fun and exciting. Whenever we're playing baseball in the park across the street with our buddies, what's the scenario in our minds? It's always bottom of the ninth, bases are loaded, tie score, full count. And you got to be the hero, whether you're pitching or hitting, you got to be the hero. And we love these scenarios. We made them up in our heads as basketball players down the street at the park, in the basketball court. It's always a tie score, 3-2-1, and we fire a three-pointer. And if we clank it off the rim and miss, what do? We run over, we shag the ball, we run back, and we start the countdown, 5-4-3, and we do it all over again. As kids, we love these pressure scenarios, and we cultivated them, we embraced them, we salt them out. And somewhere along the line, as we go through formal education and formal coaching, somewhere that gets coached out of us. And we start seeking comfort and we start seeking familiarity and we start seeking certainty. And we lose that, what I think is innately wired in us, that excitement for the pressure to want to be in those challenging, exciting environments. So I would wonder if it's still there. We just got to get back in touch with that inner kid. And kind of bring that kind of a curiosity and fascination to our practices.
Cool. And we got a last one. This coach was explaining that he has a young team and they've had a great regular season. Playoffs are coming up and he's a little concerned about their mental toughness. He's wondering if there's anything he can do to take their mindset from just being happy to be there in playoffs to having maybe higher expectations of success. Do you have any tips for making that transition?
Ooh, that's a tough one. And not knowing the context, I'm probably going to be a little bit more general in a sense. But I think something I always hear about that I think jacks up young players is when you talk about going from a regular season to now you've got a big game. You always hear this phrase, big game. So I think there's a lot of value in normalizing it to, hey, it's not the big game. It's not the one that matters now. It's just the next game. So let's prepare for the next game the way we prepared all season. Let's recognize what in our preparation allowed us to succeed all season long. And let's approach this that same way with that next game mentality. Let's not try to blow it up to be something bigger than it is, because then we start to do different things to prepare for a bigger game. And we get out of our sweet spot that's allowed us to have success all season. So for me, a lot of it is shifting from the big game mentality of postseason to more of a next game mentality. Let's prepare for this next game, these next opponents, the same way we prepared all season, and just make sure we're quality there.
That makes sense. Bernie, thank you so much. I know I was looking forward to this because I think these are a lot of questions that came up in our end of the season meeting with Stafford and John about trusting and training mindset and maybe getting in our heads and overthinking too much and just kind of shifting gears. So it's really cool to see this framework and how you kind of go through it and with some really specific examples. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you guys having me back on.
We'd have you on every week if you're up for it.
Well, I'll get in touch with you guys next week.
Done deal. Yeah, thanks so much, Bernie. We really value your information and all your knowledge. And I know everyone else out there does too, but we don't really care about them. We're selfish. So thanks for teaching us once again.
Absolutely. I appreciate the time, guys.